Okay, let's cultivate our motivation. Let's really think for a minute how everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. And really open our hearts to that fact. When we do, it really pulls us out of our self-centered ruminating, because we see everybody's in the same boat. Just as we want happiness, so do they. As intensely as we don't want misery, so do they. And this applies equally to beings we like, those we don't like, those we don't know. And so let's let all these imprisoning concepts of I'm most important, they're second, let all those fall away. And really have a heart that feels that suffering is to be eliminated no matter whose it is. And happiness is to be attained no matter whose it is. And with that, let us place our aspiration on being of the greatest benefit to all living beings and wanting to attain Buddhahood in order to do so. Let's have that be our motivation for sharing the Dharma this evening. You know how we get stuck in our ruminating trips? Anybody been stuck ruminating this last week? Just even a little bit. Oh, two people telling the truth. The rest of you? Yeah. So when we just sit there and, you know, oh, I feel unhappy, I want to be happy, why aren't I happy, I should be happy, I don't like this, I like that, but I don't have what I like, and why don't I have what I like, why don't people treat me the way I want to be treated, don't they know who I am, and I wish I could control them and make them treat me the way I want them to treat me, and I'm so miserable, and woe is me, and this isn't going to get any better, and I have to really take extreme measures, and, you know, otherwise I'm always going to be drowning in this, you know, feeling out of place, feeling like I don't belong. Yeah. Feeling, why is she talking about me? Who does she think she is? You shouldn't talk about my suffering like that and make everybody laugh at it. Doesn't she know my suffering is real? My suffering hurts more than anybody else's in the whole wide world. We don't want anybody making fun of our suffering, do we? So that's what's called ruminating. Yeah. It's pretty miserable, isn't it? It's pretty miserable. And nothing's happening on the outside. We think it's all happening on the outside, but nothing's there. And this is really something that you see when you do retreat, you know? Because in retreat, the days are pretty much the same. You follow the same routine. You're not speaking. You're doing the same sadhana. But you watch your mind be like this incredible, you know, roller coaster. You know, and nothing's changing on the outside. But our moods are just all over the place. Yeah? And this, if this is the only thing you realize in retreat, you have had a marvelously effective retreat. Because you've realized that it all comes from in here, not out there. And when you realize that, then you realize the solution is in here. It's not out there. Okay, and that's the big thing that we have to realize in the Dharma. Because if we don't get that, then we may try and try and try to practice Dharma, but nothing's going to change because in our daily life we're still doing our same old thing of, I've got to change outside. Yeah, I don't want to be with this person, I want to be with that person. I don't want to be here, I want to be there. I don't want this job, I want that job. You know? And so we're still doing the same old thing there. So we may do all sorts of Dharma practice and look very holy, but inside we're still the same confused person. And that's because we haven't gotten this fundamental Dharma principle that it's our mind that is the source of our happiness and our misery. Yeah, external things are just the conditions, aren't they? And we can see that very clearly because, you know, one external condition that for us is just miserable, somebody else loves. Yeah. Now, if that situation were objectively from its own side, independent of our mind, awful, then everybody should see it the same way. But they don't. Yeah? One person thinks it's great, one person thinks it's awful, and that really clearly shows that it's coming from our interpretation, yeah, not from the outside. And so that means that if we want happiness, we have to change in here. Because if we don't change in here, we can travel around the whole world, and like I was saying at lunch, all our defilements just trot along behind us. Okay, we aren't free of them. Okay, so that's really important, and that's kind of the whole thing about the thought training teachings that we're talking about now, how to change that focus. And so when we're ruminating, you know, the attention is totally placed on me. You know, there's just this big me at the center of the universe. And when we really put our attention focused on others, and you know, each person we look at thinking they want to be happy as much as I do, they want to be free of suffering as much as I do, then it releases all this tightness in our heart. Yeah, it really releases it, and then suddenly there's some space, and oh wow, oh, I do belong here, I'm just like everybody else. Yeah. And so when Venerable Jampal went to the prison today, he went to speak with Buddhist inmates at Oklahoma State Penitentiary. You know, this was the thing he was telling me about, of seeing the inmates as human beings just like himself. You know, and when he did that, then the environment was fine. It wasn't threatening, it wasn't scary, it wasn't anything. It was just with other human beings. But then our mind, you know, can make some small thing into an enormous thing. And we get all uptight. Then even people are trying to be nice to us, we think they're trying to harm us. Don't we? Yeah. All these people who were trying to be nice to us, and we keep saying, mind your own business, get off my case, stop trying to control me. And all they're trying to do is help. Yeah. But we have this inner teenager, don't we?
whatever you say, I reject. Whatever you do, I reject. Yeah. You want me to be happy? Fooey on you. See if you can make me happy. I'll be miserable if I want to. Says our inner teenager. Yeah. Okay, so this is, you know, working with this, this whole thing is the purpose of the thought training teachings. So we've been discussing the practices to do during one's life and the practices to do at the time of death when we're actively dying. And so these are the same five forces or five powers practiced in life and then practiced in a slightly different order with slightly different meaning, but not totally different at the time of death. So we covered how you practice it during life, and then at the time of death, we've been talking about the first of the five powers, which is the virtuous seed. Okay? And so we were talking about how it's important to purify before we die, and how it's important to accept that we're dying and just say, yes, it's completely okay. And to remember, you know, I've died many times in the past. I don't need to freak out about this. It's not something totally, you know, foreign. And also before we die, to give up attachment to anything. And especially to make generosity of our possessions so that we can create merit while we're still alive, because that merit is going to be of much more value to us than the possessions will be, because the possessions stay here, whereas the merit comes with us to the next life. Okay? So, now our author is moving into talking specifically about how we relate to our body at the time of death. Okay? Because death is merely the body and the mind before they were connected at life, and death is just that they disconnect. Yeah. So the body has its own continuity in the future, the mind has its own continuity in the future. Yeah. Okay. So we should especially eliminate attachment to our bodies at the time of death. This is because the body has been the basis of the I, or the misconception of self, the root of all disturbing emotions, wherever we have been born, in all of the six realms of existence. Okay, so based on this body, at least in the desire realm and form realms, we really feel this strong sense of I. And if you look, you know, at our common perceptions, how do we generate this feeling of I and this separate I that is unrelated to anybody else? It's on the basis of this body, isn't it? You know, my body's different than your body, therefore I'm different than you. Mm-hmm. And my body, me, is more important than your body and you. And so this grasping at an inherently existent I is the root of all the problems, because once we create this I, we fabricate it, then we have to protect it. And being attached to the body, we have indulged in the 10 unwholesome deeds, the 5 boundless actions, and other deleterious behavior in order to obtain food, clothing, and other possessions to meet our own selfish needs. So being attached to this body, we have indulged in the 10 unwholesome deeds. Okay, so we're attached to this body. So we kill animals to eat them. Okay? We're attached to this body. We steal the possessions of others to give comfort to this body. We're attached to this body. So we sleep around, you know, and have unwise sexual behavior out of attachment to the pleasures of this body. To protect this body, then we lie so that nobody will hurt it. To protect this body, we cause dissension and disharmony amongst other people so that they'll be too busy quarreling about each other to hurt our body. To protect this body, we speak harshly to others. We yell and scream at them. Yeah. To make this body appear wonderful, we do all sorts of idle talk. You know, talk about beauty and this and this and the other thing. You know, how to have a gorgeous body. And you look at the media, you know. All the media is so hung up on the body, isn't it? So many advertisements in one way or another related to this body and to pleasing this body or protecting this body. Okay? So we covet other people's things because we think those things will make our body feel good. We generate ill will, you know, against people who threaten our body. And we have a ton of wrong views about this body, don't we? Okay? So then, and the five boundless actions, they're also translated as the five heinous actions. So that's killing our father, killing our mother, killing an arhat, causing blood to flow from a Buddha, and causing disharmony in the Sangha community. Yeah, so again, all those based on attachment to the body or fear of the body. Okay, and we've engaged in other deleterious behavior in order to obtain food, clothing, and other possessions to meet our own selfish needs. So what? Give some examples of your deleterious behavior in order to obtain food. What have you done? True confession.
Kill fish.
Okay. I remember my 21st birthday, they took me out for live lobster. You know? I thought that was a big thing. Yeah. What else have we done?
Stole Halloween candy.
Yeah. Nobody's going to say take more than their fair share of whatever's that laid out. No one's going to say that. We do that one all the time. Yeah. Okay, how about to attain clothing? What did you do? Okay, wear animal skins. How about shoplifting? Mm-hmm. Anybody here shoplift when they're kids? Yeah? Often to get clothing? Okay. And then to obtain other possessions, what did you do?
Lie, cheat.
Flatter, coerce. Yeah.
Guilt trip,
manipulate, bribe, hint. Oh, bargain your Donna money, yeah. Oh, I should give it. Oh, no, I want it. How much Donna? What? Yeah, announcing our birthday so other people will. Yeah, right. Announcing our birthday early so they have plenty of time to go shopping.
Yes, that's the time I like to do that.
Yeah.
So I will also tell them, I like this all that day. I saw something like this before. It's so nice.
Yeah. So then you also say, I saw this, I saw that. Hint, hint, my birthday's coming up. You can get this. Yeah. Then we get other people to pay for the things we want.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, aren't we sweet friends?
Yeah.
They
get them to bring us to expensive restaurants.
Yeah. They take us to nice expensive restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we're incredible, aren't we? You know? We know how to do everything to flatter this body and this ego. Mm-hmm. Consequently, we are submerged in the unending sufferings of cyclic existence in general and the unbearable pains of inferior rebirths in particular. So we do all this stuff, and then what's the result of it? You know, we keep cycling in cyclic existence, one rebirth after another, because we're too busy trying to get all the stuff we want to practice the Dharma. And then, in particular, because we've created unwholesome actions, then we get born in the lower realms of existence where there's a lot of physical suffering. So that's the result of our, you know, my 21st birthday party creating the cause for the hell realm. Yeah? And see, this is why they say that we need to really be careful who our friends are. Because, I mean, it was wonderful friends who took me out to dinner for my birthday. And they really wanted me to be happy. But they didn't know about the law of karma and effect. And neither did I. And so all of us, in our ignorance, created so much negative karma. Yeah? So even though people kind of wish you well and have a good heart, if they don't understand about karma and its effects, they can inadvertently drag us into suffering, just as we can inadvertently drag them into suffering, can't we? You know? Even though our mind's thinking, oh, I'm helping. Yeah?
Some friends say, but I'm not with, how will I know if there's a hell realm? I wouldn't know.
Mm.
I won't be able to see it.
Okay. So then people say, how do I know if there's a hell realm? I can't see it. Yeah, there's lots of things we can't see. Does the fact we can't see something mean it doesn't exist? Is that a pervasion? X does not exist because I can't see it. That's not a good syllogism. That doesn't hold water. I think for me, you know, what really helped me understand the existence of the hell realms is I could see my mind getting so angry or so fearful, so tight. I wouldn't say that is a hell realm because I still have a human body. But what would happen if you took that state of mind and had it manifest as a realm and as a body? Yeah, so I began to see, okay, if I have that state of mind in a human body at the time of death, if that state of mind then, you know, act as the thing that sparked the body I took and the environment I saw around me, it would be a reflection of itself, wouldn't it? You know? So that's how I came to have some feeling that you know, the hell realm isn't just purely a state of mind. When you're born there, it's as real as our human realm is to us right now. Yeah? So if you're willing to say the human realm is just a state of mind, then you can say the hell realm's a state of mind. But if you're saying the human realm is real and the hell realm's a state of mind, I don't think so. Because there's got to be equality here, you know, and when you're born in somewhere and your mind is grasping a true existence and fabricating appearances, it's got to be, you know, as real in each of those places when you're born there. Yeah?
It seems like there's enough circumstances in human experiences that give one glimpse of that. I mean, living in an area where there's war, I mean, all the things that we see as overt suffering in my mind are places where, at least relative to where I am, that would be felt.
Yeah.
And have that all the time.
Okay. So you're saying that, you know, even in the human realm, we can see places of extreme suffering that compared to our opportunity now look like hell. But what's interesting is those situations, if you're born in them, and then if you were to look at the suffering in the hell realms, those situations would look good compared to the suffering in the hell realms. Yeah? Okay. So we have to remember the hell realms are not punishments. They're just results of our actions. You know? And sometimes when you really see kind of the depth of a negative intention that you've been holding strongly, then, I don't know about you, but I get a sense of, wow, if this intention just took over my being, yeah, it would create that kind of body that create that kind of environment. Okay. So back to the attachment to our body here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As the Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life says, whoever is attached to this body is frightened by even small things. Who would not despise as his enemy a body which gives rise to such fear? Can you see how when you're attached to the body, you're afraid? Okay? I mean, I'm attached to my body, so when the snow needs to be scraped off the roof, oh, you want to volunteer to go up there? Be my guest! You know, I'm too attached to my body to go up. Yeah? There's all sorts of ways. Frightened even by small things. I remember when I was in China with some people and we saw a dead rat in the street, and one of the people just screamed, you know, so scared of this dead rat. You know, I'm kind of going, why, you know? Yeah. But again, you know, you see attachment to the body, so then we're afraid of all these other things. So then it says, who would not despise as his enemy a body which gives rise to such fear? So here, it's not exactly the body that's giving rise to the fear, it's the attachment to the body that gives rise to the fear. So when we're talking about despising the body as one's enemy, actually it means despising the attachment to the body as one's enemy. So don't get confused and think that we hate our body. Yeah, don't get into this thing of the body is evil, the body is sinful, the body is corrupt, you know, all these kinds of things, and so actually generating a lot of self-hatred. The body is just organic material. That is all. It's just, you know, genes and chromosomes and food reconfigured. So it's not the body itself that's the enemy. It's the attachment to the body. It's the mind that makes us grasp at a body that gets old and sick and dies. Okay? So this is very important to understand. Otherwise, you get into the body is evil and sinful thing. And then that produces the flip side of the body is beautiful and I'm going to indulge my body. And both of those attitudes are really unrealistic when it comes to relating to this blob of organic material. Okay? So very important, and I really stress this because in our culture people have so many, you know, underlying even nonverbal ideas about their body that they get quite, you know, disturbed by, or these concepts disturb them a lot. Okay? So don't, you know, be unaware of, understand these verses. Okay? Wishing to find, this is also from Bodhisattva Avatara, wishing to find a means to relieve this body's hunger, thirst, and sickness, you kill birds, fish, and deer, and loiter by the roadside to rob others. Okay? Loiter by the roadside. You stand by the roadside as a bandit, you know? I mean, this happens in Iraq all the time, many countries, you know? And you're robbed. There's been things of pirates, you know, robbing people. You kill birds, fish, and deer. When we were in Montana last weekend, a few of us took a walk, you know, behind Tom's house, and two hunters were carting off a dead buck, and it really made me very sad because it was in this kind of, what do you call it? It was almost like a baby carriage attached to a bicycle, except there was a buck lying in it, and where you would expect to see the kid's face, there was the buck's face. It was so sad to see this. And, you know, people killing this animal, feeling very proud of it, you know, and to, you know, out of attachment to food or reputation or something. If for the sake of profit and comfort you would even kill your father and mother and misappropriate offerings to the three jewels, you will burn in the most severe hell. Okay, so for profit and comfort of this body, even killing your father and mother. So do you remember there was a case in L.A. some years ago, two brothers killing both parents? Okay, so you see this kind of thing. Oh, what's the recent case? That one, that one really rich lady, Esther, some rich, huh? Exactly. She had dementia, and her son, robbed and stole and confiscated all of her possessions. She was quite a wealthy store, wasn't it? Yeah, in the New York elite. You know? As if he didn't have enough money than doing this to his own mother. Yeah? So. You know, it happens. Misappropriating offerings to the three gems, three jewels. So you see, like the young boys who were enlisted in the People's Liberation Army in China when they went throughout China and Tibet and took things from the temples. Yeah, misappropriating offerings to the three jewels for their own benefit or, given to the state, something like that. So you can see when there's ignorance in the mind, very often people think they're doing something good, but they're actually creating a lot of negative karma because they don't know what negative and they can't differentiate it. And they also can't differentiate what's a positive motivation and a negative one. Okay, what wise person would desire, protect, and coddle this body? Well, I desire, protect, and coddle this body. I guess I'm pretty unwise. Yeah? We pamper this body, don't we? So much. Oh, this is wrong with my body. I don't feel well. All these, things. And so, when we have that kind of view, then a lot of our day goes into taking care of this body, or we feel a little bit sick. I can't practice the Dharma. I have to go to bed. A little bit of discomfort. I got to leave the meditation hall. Got to do this, that, the other thing. I'll go to the doctor. Run here, run there. Go to bed. Eat special soup. Got to have this special this that. Because my body. It's. And at the end of the day, there's very little time to practice. Okay. Who would not scorn it and regard it as an enemy? So when we really see the disadvantages of being attached to this body, then we would scorn the attachment to the body. Okay. Don't hate the body. See the body for what it is. It's vegetable goo. Yeah, that's all it is. Would you go in the kitchen and take, some leftovers and worry about those leftovers with the same intensity as we worry about our body? I don't think so. Yeah, so just seeing the body for what it is. We take care of it. We keep it clean. We keep it healthy. We have to in order to practice. If the body's not healthy, it makes practice difficult. But we can do that without attachment, without fussing, without indulging. Okay? So we don't go to the other extreme of torturing the body and denying the body and making ourselves sick, because that doesn't do any good either. Okay, so this middle way is hard, isn't it? But we keep on trying to get it, We go to this extreme, that extreme, try and get in the middle. So we should make a strong determination to not adopt such an inferior body, the product of karma and afflictions in the future. but to let the reality of the mind, its lack of inherent existence, rest in the perfect body of truth. Okay, so at the time of death, you know, we need a strong determination not to take another body like this one that's under the control of ignorance and afflictions and karma, but instead to let our mind rest in the nature of reality, the emptiness of inherent existence, which here is called the perfect body of truth. It's a play on the word body, because when we say truth body, it doesn't, here, their body doesn't mean physical body. Their body means like a collection of things. Okay. Yeah, because we can use the word body as a collection, can't we? Yeah. Okay. So, the power of the white seed. Yeah, that's our first one. So give away the objects of attachment, and because people can have a hard time dying when they're very attached to the things and people around them. You know, they feel so attached. I can't leave this. I don't want to leave this. So it's better just to give it away. Okay. That's very, very important. Just to let go of attachment to the body. Let go of attachment to possessions. Okay. Don't worry about what's going to happen to our stuff. Don't worry about what's going to happen to our body. You know, some people are very concerned about what's going to happen to their body after they die. Yeah? And you can see our society in general, the way we honor the dead is as if the person were still their body. And so the person's gone, but we take their body, we bathe it, we adorn it, we put it in a casket, we march it here and there and put a flag over it or salute it or, you know, offer flowers to it. Or we have all these customs in our society, yeah? Because we're kind of, you know, the body's the only thing remaining of the person at that time. And so some people, you know, actually while they're alive, they're very concerned. What's going to happen to my body when I die? You know, I want my body to be all put back together and to look nice and to look like me so that everybody will remember me well. Yeah, some people are quite attached to this kind of thing. But in reality, you know, when we die, I mean, why not offer this body to the birds and the worms? Because it's of no benefit to us at that time. You know, it's just organic matter. That what good is it going to do us when we die? So I really understand why in ancient Tibet, you know, they would often take the bodies up and pack them up and offer them to the birds. You know, do something useful with this body. And I think now there's a friend of mine wrote that because, you know, cremation is very bad for the environment. It puts all sorts of, greenhouse gases in the environment. I had never thought of this before. But she said it's very bad for the environment to cremate. And so there's this kind of movement now just to, you know, bury the body without some fancy thing and in a casket and all this, but just return the body to the earth and bury it. Yeah. So how would we feel about that? Well, when we think of people who have, their bodies have been put in mass graves, you know, it seems very disrespectful. But, you know, but that's our human way of thinking, because at that time the body is of no use to the person. They're off experiencing something else at that time. And so we too, you know, when we die, as we're approaching death, you know, don't worry about, you know, do I look okay? And yeah, are they going to treat my body well after I die? Because we're going to be off somewhere else, you know, caught up in our own karmic reality. Yeah? Okay. Then the second, according to this book, the second one is The Power of Intention. When Lama Yeshe taught it, he said it's the power of aspiration. So they're taught, number two and number four are reversed in the two ways, but actually their meaning comes down to the same. You know, because the power of motivation, the power of aspiration, they're very similar, aren't they? What you motivate yourself, what you inspire yourself. Okay, so here in the book, The Power of Intention is very short. As explained above, we should have three types of intention related to the long, medium, and short terms. Okay, so seeking a good rebirth, seeking liberation, seeking enlightenment. Okay, the way Lama taught it, this one, is as the second one was the power of aspiration. So he was saying, do the seven limb prayer, you know, with the seven branches, prostration, offering, confession, rejoicing, requesting teachings, requesting the guru to remain, and dedication. Yeah, to do the seven limb prayer, to make offerings to our spiritual mentor and the three jewels. Okay, to confess broken vows and to renew our vows. So to do, you know, Vajrasattva, or recite the names of the 35 Buddhas, even if we can't do the prostrations, we can still recite the names. Even if you're dying and you can't think that clearly, then just in your mind generating the four opponent powers. Okay, then also offering our seeds of virtue and pray that at the time of death, in the intermediate stage, or the bardo stage, and in our next rebirth, when may we never be separated from the practice of bodhicitta. So that's a very important aspiration to set forth. May I never be separated from the practice of bodhicitta. May I never be separated from these thought training teachings. Yeah, may I always be guided by a true spiritual master who leads me to cultivate bodhicitta. You know, these kind of aspirations are so important to make during our life, and especially at the time of death, you know, because at the time of death, you know, depending on what thoughts we have, and also depending what karma is stronger, certain karma will ripen, and then that propels our mind to take a certain, you know, physical body. And so it's very important at that time to have all sorts of virtuous aspirations, you know, because that will direct our mind in a certain direction and make a good karma ripen. Yeah. So, you know, we have to really look at what we aspire for. What are our aspirations in life? You know, I want to play on the hockey team. Yeah. I want to win at the fair. I want to get the most interest on my investment. I want. You know, but do we ever say, I want to, you know, I aspire always to have a fully qualified Mahayana teacher who teaches me the thought training practice and teaches me meditation on emptiness and conventional bodhicitta? Do we say, you know, is that our aspiration? Do we make that aspiration? Or do we just kind of, you know, oh yeah. But what I really want is a hot fudge sundae. You know? Okay. So, you know, really seeing what we aspire for and in our life, and especially at the time of death, set these strong aspirations. Okay. So we usually dedicate for enlightenment, you know, at the end of our meditation sessions, we dedicate for our own and others' enlightenment. At the time of death, it's very important, in addition to dedicating for enlightenment, to dedicate to have a fortunate rebirth where we can continue practicing. Okay? So that's very, very important. Yeah. Now, some people will dedicate to be born in a pure land, you know, where there's so many opportunities to practice and no hindrances to practice. If you're a real practitioner of this thought training, instead of praying to be reborn in the Pure Land, you pray to generate bodhicitta and take on the suffering of others. That's your prayer at the time of death. You want to take on the suffering and obscurations of all sentient beings. Okay. But think about that. At the time of death, you know, when you're separating from everything in this life and your whole ego identity and your body's sick and you feel really spaced out, to really think, you know, I want to take on the suffering of and obscurations of all sentient beings. And to not be afraid at that time of doing that, but to really think, you know, I really want to do that. So I think this is one way in which we can help each other if we happen to be near each other when we're dying, is to really remind each other, you know, pray to be able to take on the obscurations and sufferings of others, and don't be afraid of doing that, you know, and pray to always meet the bodhicitta teachings and be able to practice them and have a teacher that teaches them correctly, you know. So this reminding somebody who's a practitioner at the time of death is very good, you know. Really take on the sufferings of others. Don't get involved in what's appearing to your mind. Just focus on taking on the suffering of others. There's the story of one lama, and when he was dying, he was kind of upset, and his student was saying, you know, why are you so upset? You've created so much virtue in his life. And he said, well, because I've been praying to be reborn in the hell realm to benefit the sentient beings there, and instead I'm having visions of the Pure Land. Okay? So, you know, that's the result of having that kind of love and compassion for others, is that you get born in the Pure Land. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
What if there was someone who's dying and they get really, really scared, and suggesting that to them or trying to say those thoughts makes them more scared?
Okay, so what happens if you're with somebody and you suggest that and instead they get very tight and frightened and all? Then you change tact, because you realize that that's not skillful at that moment, and instead you tell them to think of the Buddha and to think of their spiritual master and to make very strong prayers to their spiritual mentor and to the Buddha to be born in the Pure Land, to have a favorable rebirth, to be free of all suffering. Yeah. So you give them something that is more suitable for their state of mind at that time. What happens if they're not a Buddhist?
No, yeah. Buddhist, no religion, no faith, nothing, you really believe in themselves.
Yeah, okay. So people who,
yeah,
who you know, don't belong to any religion at all and are just, you know, thinking of this lifetime, then ask them to remember the loving heart, the kind heart, and, you know, because everybody values this, whether you are religious or secular, everybody thinks having a kind heart, having love and compassion are good. And so tell the person, you know, have a loving heart towards others, rejoice in all the positive deeds that you did, you know, aspire to be able to do many good deeds and to benefit many sentient beings in the future. Yeah, so you tell them that. Okay? So you put them in a positive state of mind. Okay. Okay, then the three is the power of remorse, or also translated as the power of destruction. So here it says, remembering the disadvantages of the disturbing emotions, we should protect ourselves from being overwhelmed by them. Okay, so what we're trying to destroy is all the afflictions, the disturbing emotions, and we want to protect our mind from being overwhelmed by them. Because at the time of death, you know, it could be very easy for our mind to be overwhelmed by afflictions, couldn't it? Attachment to this body, fear of what happens after death, you know, worry about leaving our loved ones, you know, regret for non-virtues we've done, anger at people that we haven't liked during our life, guilt over harmful actions, you know, it would be very easy for our mind to be filled with afflictions at the time of death. So it's very important instead at the time of death to see those afflictions as what are to be destroyed, okay, and focus on that. So we want to understand at the time of death as we're dying that grasping onto our body, grasping onto friends, grasping onto possessions, grasping onto status, grasping even onto the thought I am, okay, grasping to the self, that grasping to friends and relatives, okay, grasping to familiar situations, to really see as we're dying and at the time of death that all this kind of grasping, and particularly the grasping of the self, is the primary cause for us cycling in cyclic existence. Okay? And so instead of at the time of death, the grasping coming up and all we do is grasp, to say, oh, this grasping, this is the thing that keeps me bound in cyclic existence. I need to relax my mind. There's nothing to grasp at here. Okay? So to see clinging, grasping, craving, to see these very tight minds as the actual enemy and try to either release it and let the mind relax or specifically apply the meditations on emptiness so that we really obliterate this kind of grasping. Okay? And Lama, when he was teaching at this, he said something that has always stuck with me. He said, the body and mind don't need grasping. Yeah? So the body doesn't need grasping. The mind doesn't need grasping. There's no reason to grasp for either our body or our mind. They don't need it. Yeah. So instead of letting this grasping and fear at the time of death is, you know, provoked by this grasping, instead of letting that control us, just realize the body and mind don't need grasping. Yeah. There's nothing there that needs to be grasped at. Okay? And so to make a very strong determination not to let our body, speech, and mind go under the influence of ignorance, anger, and clinging attachment. Yeah? To try and, though when we're talking about destruction, so destroying those. Purify our negative karma. Yeah, this is also involved in the power of destruction so that we destroy these negative karmic seeds so we can do Vajrasattva, you know, or take self-initiation if you're well enough to do it or anything. And then to make, you know, again, very strong prayers. May I not be born in a place where the thought training teachings and the bodhicitta are absent or are rare. Yeah. But instead, may I always be born near them and in good conditions to meet the Dharma and practice it. Because you really see, you know, there's so many places to be born in. There's so many things we could be born as. And all you can have many, many good conditions. But if you have just one bad one, that can make it so that all the other good ones, you know, can't serve their purpose. Okay. Look at our kitties. Or are they? Oh, one's out there, one's up there. You know, here they are. They've met many Buddhist masters. They've heard many teachings. They're in a Dharma environment. But because they're born in a cat body, they can't make use of all that opportunity they have. Okay? Or you're born as a human being, and you meet the Dharma, but then there's some very heavy negative karma that ripens, and so we have a short life. Or you're born in a central area, the Dharma's all around, but you have no interest in it. Yeah? So you can see it's so possible to have many good conditions, and then if there's one strong bad one, the good ones are rendered useless at that time. So it's very important to make these kinds of aspirations and prayers and dedications and really put our mind on that. Yeah, having the complete conditions, not let our mind go, you know, I want the complete conditions for Dharma practice. And by the way, hot fudge Sundays. Okay. Yeah? Yeah. But because then we might just get the hot fudge Sundays and lose out on the real delight. Okay, any questions?
So, at the time of death, it sounds like that wherever your mind is and however you direct it, that it's so much more powerful at that time. So mm-hmm. you really can... I'm not sure why that is.
Okay. She's saying that it seems like at the time of death where you direct your mind is much more powerful. And why is that? That's because we don't know what karma is going to ripen in the dying process that is going to be the karma that will determine our next rebirth. That isn't set out. It's not predestined. So the factors that make karma ripen, one of them is the state of your mind. Okay? So if you have a good state of mind, it's easier for a good karma to ripen. If you have a negative state of mind, much more difficult for some positive karma to ripen. Okay? And because that karma which will determine what we get reborn as ripens at that time when we're actively dying, then it's quite important. Now, does that mean that we don't need to pay so much attention to our state of mind while we're alive and just at the time of death have our Dharma friends around to remind us of a good intention? No. Okay. First of all, we don't know when and where we're going to die, and we can't guarantee that our Dharma friends or our teacher are going to be there and that we're going to have plenty of time for them to remind us and blah, blah, blah. We might have to go it alone. Okay. And also, even if they were there, we are creatures of habit, you know? And our life, we keep on displaying the same habits. So, you know, at the time that we're dying, we are still living and we are still, you know, going to tend to go towards the same mental states that we had while we were not actively dying and still living. Okay? We are creatures of habit. So that's why it's so important when afflictions arise now to really counteract them and not let them continue on in the mind. Yeah, because we really need that practice, that, you know, in counteracting the afflictions so that we have that habit to counteract them and we have the habit of our mind going in a virtuous way so that it doesn't it just habitually go in the negative way. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's why it's so important when negative states of mind arise that we try and resolve them as soon as possible instead of just holding on to that mood and that ruminating and that whatever it is. Yeah? Okay. Because it's all practice for the time when we are actually going to die. And my friend Alex, you know, was telling me. No, because we hear all of this of how to think when you're dying and all of this. And he said one day he was walking in the bazaar in Lower Dharamsala. And, you know, he'd been studying and practicing for years. And he slipped on something in the street and fell. And he said the thought that came into his mind, automatic thought, you know, which happens so quickly because, you know, when you slip and fall, you know, you don't have time to think, what am I going to think? But the automatic thought that came in his mind was, oh, shit. You know? And he said that when that happened, he went, oh, my goodness, what happened if, you know, at the time I died, this is my automatic thought that comes in my mind. Yeah? Just out of habit.
Yeah.
Yeah? So he felt quite concerned and worried about this. And, you know, this is why it's important to constantly, you know, try and guide the mind towards something virtuous and away from something that isn't. Yeah. So sometimes when you're falling asleep, can you see, do you get images and thoughts and things as you're falling asleep? So if you are aware of them, can you kind of detect, oh, my mind's going in a negative way, I got to switch it at this point when you're falling asleep? Or does the mind just kind of go with it? Yeah? It's interesting to watch, isn't it? Okay, so we'll stop here for now, and then next week continue. Hopefully we will all be alive, I don't know.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine action spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Florida.